Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thank you for downloading the Giles Corran Has No Idea podcast. This week, Esther and I are on holiday, so yay! But only in England, so, well, still yay, just a bit quieter. But rather than leave you with nothing to listen to, because you can't listen to nothing, how else could you bear the housework or the gardening or whatever you do to kill the time when we're droning on, we will be bringing you two special new and totally different podcasts, which may or may not have been aired in the last couple of weeks on my Times radio show. This entirely new and totally original podcast is called Desert Island Crisps. Each week I take a major celebrity, generally an old friend of mine, so that I'm not all nervous when they come round to my house expecting to be fed, and set them adrift on a desert island without food or drink, and then invite them to tell us the eight things they would most miss eating in such a situation, and we try to provide a few of them, learning, along the way, a little bit about what makes them tick. This week, it's the Right Honourable Lord of the Dance and King of the Courtroom, Judge Rinder, known to me, his biggest fan, but only relatively newish friend, as Rob. So, Rob, we haven't even started and you're on a barocca.
I know.
Is that one of your...
It's my morning ritual.
It's not your desert island snack.
Oh, God, I didn't think of that, actually. I should need some vitamins. No, I've been to the gym because I put on 2 stone during lockdown and Barry's is back, albeit socially distanced.
Barry's boot camp.
Yeah.
Okay, so I read a lovely piece you wrote sometime during it about Barry's boot camp and how you're missing out on it and it had this terrible effect on your body. Pretty sharp to me.
No, it's a disaster. I look like a Picasso at the moment. My belly button's down on my thigh and my tits are in my ears. It's complete horror. I look like a sort of nightmare scenario of what I didn't want to become and what I did look like in my 20s.
So what has gone wrong?
Well, I mean, I've got no self-control as what's gone wrong. And also, I've been really depressed, despite all the privilege that I have, you know, inordinate amounts of it and always have, you know, access to outside, no reason I can't go running, etc. You know, whenever I get depressed or down or sort of lose a sense of, I don't know, sort of possibility, I spend too much time with myself, I end up eating and eating and eating and have no capacity to portion size. And the other thing is I'm no good at cooking. And the one thing that didn't happen during lockdown is they didn't stop Deliveroo. Not long ago, I got a call from my accountant saying that, this genuinely happened, said that I can't remember the words he used precisely, but it was something like, you need to rein in your Deliveroo addiction. He used that word because it's about the same price as a moderately successful cocaine user. Why he used the word successful, but there you are.
Blimey. So what are you eating on Deliveroo then?
Well, sort of it's...
junk or posh stuff? Because Deliveroo, you know, the number one thing on Deliveroo is KFC. I had to give it an award at the Deliveroo Awards. I say had to. I was well paid to. And I was slightly shocked that the Deliveroo Restaurant of the Year was KFC.
Really?
And I had to stand there. Lucky they paid well. I had to stand there as a restaurant critic saying, yeah, and KFC is there. Is that what you're having on?
No, that's my illness food. That's when I'm really depressed.
Sorry, it's my mother trying to call me because it's my birthday and she hasn't had a chance.
Your birthday today?
Yeah.
What?
Yes.
How did I not know that? I bought you chillot.
I know.
Oh my God, I'm actually here on your birthday. This is like the apotheosis of a lifelong ambition. And I know that your listeners, well, they may know about it because I've written about you twice in my column.
I know.
You know, I've said this before. I'm never excited by sort of famous people. I suppose because over the years, people from university have gone to become like mega famous, like Benedict or whoever. And I don't know with actors and that sort of thing. But after the initial flush of recognition, it's always, well, not Ben's not like this. But, you know, it's a bit, you know, enough about me. What do you think about me? You know, actors. I mean, some of them are thinly interesting, but they've always got some hypocritical campaign that they're involved in. And, you know, especially if they've spent time in LA, you know, normally because of the toxic environment they've been in, which enables the worst sorts of behaviours. Nobody wants to spend any time around them. But the people that were famous or that you fancied when you were a little bit younger are always the people you're most excited by. And in fact, you share a birthday with my other crush, Andy Peters, who's 50 today.
Is he?
Yeah. I know, and you look just
as good. You say other crush?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, here's the thing. When I used to watch you with Sue Perkins, I was obviously a bit grown up by then, but you were the last of those sort of crushes. So when I first met you, there was no way I was going to do well. And there never is. There's never a moment. And I say this, you know, there's never a moment when I see you, I don't feel that just little bit of sort of excitement.
Now, listen, why don't we focus?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there are so many things I want to talk about, but I mean, I want to talk about the fact, because you had the virus. I think before we depend, is that all right?
I think
before we get onto the food, so you're saying you've been depressed in lockdown, you've been eating to compensate and stuff.
Yeah.
You had the virus when?
Yeah, I mean, the sort of first week was sort of a bit grim, but then week two, I had a little bit of a crash, to be honest. It was, it was a temperature and a cough and this sort of delirium. It's the best way I can describe it. It must have been because I found myself with my knees on the floor. I try not to look at you. My body on the bed. And I watched back-to-back Kardashians. I sort of couldn't turn it off, couldn't sort of take my eyes off it. And friends were delivering food, which was very sweet, including one of the things on that list, which is why it's on that list. One day, I was trying to eat because I figured it was a coronavirus. I was trying to crowd out the corrosive white noise of the various information, of the various bits and pieces that were coming in from the news. You will die. You will die. And, that was kind of challenging and got a little bit troubling after a while. But, you know, I managed to sort of switch that off. But I was ordering food, thinking it was a coronavirus. I was supposed to, my grandma said, you know, feed a cold. Cold is a coronavirus. Starve a virus. So I thought, well, if I eat and eat and eat, that will help. And I tried to. And one day I ordered a pizza and was wearing a onesie, and delivery changed their policy where they weren't allowed to hand over food. And I answered the door, and the man delivering the food sort of looked at me. I was genuinely delirious. Sort
Can
of
you
like,
just describe the onesie for me?
It's a black starred onesie with a hood.
And you had the hood up, or...?
I'd say I had the hood up. I didn't really know. And
so we had a really famous, a high flying, seriously successful barrister with his own TV series, star of Strictly Come Dancing, opened the door dressed in a black starred onesie with the hood possibly up, possibly not, and the pizza guy was taken aback.
It wasn't that he was taken aback. He sort of looked at me because I was, I was pointing to him, put the thing on the floor because obviously he hadn't got the memo not to hand it over, and I was sort of worried about transmission, that sort of thing. So. He looked at me like, I'm trying to think, like my first driving examiner. He'd gone sort of peritonitis grey. My first driving examiner, halfway through the test, said, "Are you trying to kill us both?" Made us stop and walk back to the test centre. I didn't think much of it, but he put it on the floor. I picked up the pizza and tried to eat it and then sat on the sofa. And I thought, oh, no, the shivers have come again. This is a nightmare. Just when's it going to end? I looked down. Of course, the whole of the front of my onesie was open.
Was open.
Yes, love. It was an absolute... I thought, God, that's it. I'm going to end up, you know, in the tabloids.
so you weren't... And how long did it last, the virus?
Like 17 days. And the weird thing was, it literally ended after 17 days. And I... when the test became available for everybody, the antibody test, I had an antibody test much later on, and I had it pretty
strongly. So you're now free?
Well, I don't know, because we don't know the science. You know, somebody I heard recently had acquired it again, but I did feel a little bit like immuno-He-Man walking around, and I feel sure that that's influenced the choices I've made and how I've responded to it, getting on the tube, and albeit with a mask on and going to Barry's. I wonder if I'd feel like that if I hadn't had it.
We want to talk about, I want to talk about your desert island, desert island crisps. We call it desert island crisps, but, you know, you've actually gone for some. I've had to do some cooking here, or I would possibly potentially have to do some cooking. You've gone for some serious
food. You have to do a lot of cooking.
We want to tell your life, which and we know the story a little bit. I know the story of your Jewish Orthodox upbringing up in sort of Enfield, Southgate.
Southgate, right.
And then, you know, through your school days, your brilliant legal career, into your TV career. You laugh. I looked it up. You got a first. You were a very serious... You could have been a serious contender. You still are, of course. but also a big TV star and then exponentially more famous as a Strictly... Normally we reveal the foods one at a time, but I'm going to look through them and ask. I mean, you say you're now on a diet. Do you want? Yeah. I've got some of these things. Do you want to eat anything?
Yeah, I mean, it depends what it is. But
okay,
I'm not...
so we've got schmaltz herring. You said now I've got some roll mops.
No, that doesn't absolutely.
Okay, well we'll come back and talk about it.
I do eat roll mops, but schmaltz herring is. I mean, there is a hierarchy of herring.
This is your first desert island food.
Definitely.
What is it about schmaltz herring? With onions and a glass of scotch.
Yeah, this would be what I would eat before they send me off this mortal coil, for sure. It's
describe schmaltz herring to my non-Jewish listeners, of whom there may be one or two.
It just somehow articulates, you know, Ashkenazi Judaism in one salty bite. It's basically herring, which is marinated in salt and fat. I mean, schmaltz means fat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's slimy and fishy and smelly and just a little bite of heaven. And for me, it is so much more than that. It's the smell, the taste, the memory, I guess, of my childhood, and most especially of my grandfather, who came from Poland.
And on which side?
My mum's dad.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a Holocaust survivor. And on Friday night, and a lot more, he spent a lot of time with him. My mum was a single mum. And after school, my grandma used to pick us up from school. She used to make amazing meals. And he was a baker.
The grandfather.
By trade, incredible baker, which is fascinating because I have no transferable skills whatsoever. I can't. Baker back in Poland and here, and a kosher caterer. And so food was absolutely everything to him. You know, on two levels, because he worked in it, because that's what he did,
mm-hmm.
but also because of his experience in the Holocaust, when you spent time with him, and in fact, if you ever have the gift to spend time with other Holocaust survivors, the thing that they center around most is food. And of course, that's part of the Jewish cultural dynamic, but it's so much more
mm-hmm.
around people who have had that lived experience of being starved.
Mm-hmm.
And so food wasn't just love, it was so much more. When my grandfather was dying, in 2001,
mm-hmm.
incredibly powerful man, extraordinary person. One of the things that we discovered, and he died, you know, albeit having lived his life like the shtetl, as we say, you know, like the town in Anatevka and Fiddler on the Roof. He wasn't a sophisticated person by any stretch of the imagination.
So was he from? He was from the shtetls in Poland?
Yeah.
I
was from a town called Piotrków, which was a sort of town, but I've been back there. You know, I did it for Who Do You Think You Are?
Yeah.
And I've made a couple more documentaries about it. And he dotted about the place in the backs of drawers and in the backs of wardrobes were little handkerchiefs. And you opened them and there were food. There was food in them. You know, you watch them standing around a buffet, his friends, the survivors, and they want to feed you. Eat, eat.
Mm-hmm.
It's much more than an edict. It was something about the delight in food, that sense of having this emotional muscle memory of knowing what it meant not to have it. And to be cold. You know, I went back to Poland.
So was he in the, when you say Holocaust survivor, people use it to mean all sorts of states, you know, for Jews who, was he in the camps?
Yeah. So he was from Piotrków and he, first of all, was conscripted as slave labor to work in a glass factory. And his four sisters and his brother and his father and mother were sent to Treblinka and murdered. And then he ended up in a place called Skarzysko Kamenna. And then in Schlieben, which was a subcamp of Buchenwald, where I stood with one of his fellow survivors, Sir Ben Helfgott. It was an extraordinary moment as I saw him there in this wood. And he said to me, and I knew that they'd kind of known each other, and he said, as I saw him, I'd like to tell you what your grandfather looked like when I saw him here. And it's a strange thing, because a lot of people, when they think about the Holocaust, intuitively, understandably, think about Auschwitz, which is an extraordinarily moving and powerful place and a disturbing place. And the, I suppose, articulate expression of what the Holocaust was, this machine of death, it represented the modernity of the German killing machine, the efficiency, someone sitting in an office at arm's length and working out the precise calculation of how best to kill somebody. That's Mm-hmm. That's what, anyway, left me when I was there. But of course, the millions of others were killed in such different ways. And of course, this camp has been covered by nature. There's just the jagged suggestion of what was there.
And that's all just a mouthful of Schmaltz herring.
I mean, mouthful of Schmaltz herring. Right, and the scotch, which is really important.
From all that, I think the drink is important
I've
too.
Got a, anyway, if you were to... I should say, the funny thing about the Schmaltz herring, this is to add a funny story, he used to take it everywhere, didn't care what it smelt like. And the thing is, whenever we, even on planes, right, we would go to wherever it was, Israel, he'd take us to Bournemouth, and on the train or the plane, he'd have a Schmaltz herring sandwich, and it stank. Oh, I mean, it didn't just smell bad. I mean, I'm trying to think of a clean fish analogy, but the difficulty is I'm looking at you and my mind goes instantly head first into the gutter, Charles.
I know well the smell of Schmaltz herring. It's a shame we haven't got some here because we would be sort of...
I know.
But look, let's move on to let's move on from Schmaltz herring to what you have now. Number two, I see, is chopped meat. Mm. Could mean anything.
Now, chopped meat could mean anything, and it's a specific dish to my grandmother. She makes Maureen Lipman seem like Sister Wendy. She's the most Jewish human being you've ever met.
This is your dad's mum.
Still alive. So in the 90s.
And so your mother and father split up when you were...
Right, five or six.
Your dad's a cab driver?
That's right, yeah.
And you lived with...
My mum.
Your mum. So you were around the Holocaust surviving grandfather who died in 2001?
2001, yeah.
But on the other side, cab driver,
right?
Jewish parents, not Holocaust survivors.
Yeah, no, they're born in England, as are most of their parents too.
It's exactly the dynamic of my mother's parents came from Slovakia, survived, they weren't in the camps, but their family were all killed. Mm. My father's ones were up Southgate your way. Right. They'd been here since the 1890s. Much jollier proposition.
Yeah. Well, jollier proposition, not so much. I mean, they came from the East End in, abject poverty. I should add, my mum, who, was a housewife and, lived in a kind of, we lived in a, not your bit of Southgate, we were in the working class bit. And, she went from having no job, etc., to, going back to study to running a big publishing company. And so, which is an extraordinary thing, and, you're not supposed to use this language, but I don't give a monkey. She went on a real journey, intellectual, spiritual, cultural, the lot, which is an extraordinary thing because sort of we grew alongside one another. And she had this sort of extraordinary success and, I suppose, went through the various... class ceilings. And I had my dad, who was a taxi driver, very working class. But what my mum always fundamentally understood, and I suppose it's part of the thing that I'm always mindful of when I sit on family cases in my court, is that she knew that, ultimately kids find out who their parents are. And so if you are, whatever the toxic dynamic in your relationship, so long as you're mindful and you put your kids first and you understand it's critical they have relationships with, their fathers, parents, etc. In the long run, that could only be for the good. And she was always mindful of that. So I had this great relationship with all of my dad's family. They were absolutely part of my childhood growing up. My grandma is genuinely epic. I mean...
And tell me about her chopped meat.
It is, right. I don't even know how she makes it. But it's like unconditional delight and love in a meatball. It's basically like a meatball. Actually, I recently had something called Russian cutlets, which it must be based on. Some people call it Eingedämpfter. It's slow-cooked meatballs. She used to do it with turkey when she was worried about heart disease, and it still tasted the same. I don't know how she does it. It's like a little ball of magic. I mean, she had had this very, very... troubled childhood. She was the only daughter of slightly elderly parents. Her mum had multiple sclerosis and her dad had had a stroke, so she became the breadwinner at 11 or 12. Consequently, like a lot of people in that generation who were traumatized themselves that went on to be parents, mm-hmm. They by natural extension passed that trauma on to you,
of course,
or to the second generation, and that of course interferes with your emotional chemistry in a whole range of ways that we're not necessarily aware of. And she used to tell these kind of horrendous stories, of her childhood and stuff, each one more bleak and dark than the next. And she used to just say the most extraordinary things, and she still does, honestly.
At what age?
96. You're 92. You can't actually believe some of the things that come out of her mouth. But I absolutely know and knew that she loved me and delighted in me with complete passion and joy. You know, you could turd on the floor and she would consider that art. I wrote my thesis. It was, at the time, basically a political discourse. Discourse, listen to me, a discourse. It was a piece about gay pornographic cinema. So I did this thesis and, you know, it won a prize and all the rest of it. And my grandma came to my graduation. She said, "Darling, what's your story about?" So I sort of coughed loudly whilst she was...
And she made this... one of these days, I'm going to have me around for it.
The chopped meat, she can't make it anymore. And like when she couldn't... You know what? This is actually,
she needs to pass on the recipe to you.
That would involve cooking is a difficult... But actually, I would learn it. You know, I have to tell you, and without getting too emotional, we're not on... Well, I suppose. I remember going around there not long ago, and it was like a really serious thing. I can't look at you and get emotional. She said, it was really interesting. I only thought about this just as we were talking about it. She said, "I'm really sorry. She's got rheumatoid arthritis. I can't make chopped meat anymore." And she was really saddened by it. And it mattered to her. It wasn't, it was her delight in the food and the delight in us eating it and what it meant for her. You know, she obviously wasn't a person of much money or anything of that kind, but this was a thing that she could do that she knew absolutely for certain that we would enjoy. And she did the best. It's about what the food means and the love permeating into it and how it tastes. I always think, you know, whenever you go around to somebody's house, I try not to go around to people's houses when they cook, apart from perhaps yours or whatever. There's nothing more dispiriting than arriving at someone's house and they say, "We've made fish."
You have to allow me to segue to the next food then, because you've talked about you like loving your food, but you hate it when people do fish. Number three, and we're going slowly through the foods here. Fillet of fish from McDonald's. Filet au fish.
It's the only thing to order from there. If I had addiction, it's food crack for me.
The filet au fish.
Yeah, I can't have
one. Kosher in youth, not eating.
Right, so when my parents divorced, we used to go to Hebrew school on a Sunday. And my dad, who similarly, I think has, in fact, I'm certain, has no transferable skills at all, can't use a hammer or anything of that kind. And it's sort of that taste of the 80s, being sort of collected, knowing that I'd have to engage in some sort of species of conversation and not judge him. He would have girlfriends who I would constantly sort of be talking to. I was often giving sort of emotional advice to his girlfriends and our au pairs. You know, they'd go out with boyfriends, and after the first sort of visit, I'd say, "Oh, that needs a rethink." I was probably 8 or 9, genuinely.
You know, you were their gay best friend even when you were 8?
Definitely. Yeah. I still get letters.
Do you find, as Judge Rinder and as the TV star that you are now, that a lot of straight Gentile women...
It's Gentile women, yeah.
But do particularly women relate to you as a sort of guy who's...
Maybe. I have this wonderful... I love them so much. I really do. There's a group called the Rinderettes, and they're a royal family, and they're very devoted and they're brilliant. And they genuinely support one another. And I love that. Yeah. In fact, I should tell you, not the Rinderettes, I must emphasise. You must keep that in. I've never had any kind of fan mail from any man at all. But I have had quite a few letters from women in various forms of undress saying, "Look, I know I'm not your thing, but, you know, I thought this might tip you over the edge." I'm always write a kind letter back saying, you know, "That's definitely your colour, but sadly, on this occasion..."
So we've leapt straight to the Rinderettes, and I'm happy with that. But I mean, you obviously did well at school. Fillet of fish.
Oh,
and that's the taste of your parents' divorce.
Yeah, and now that's my guilt food. That's what I would have. You know, I can't have one. I can eat three in one sitting. It's the tartar sauce, and
I find them. I mean, I grew up on Big Macs. I find the fillet of fish are tricky.
It's marvelous. It's just And I was at New Zealand airport, not New Zealand. I was in Auckland airport, and it's the only place in the world where you can double up on the fish patty, and I missed it. I'm so upset.
What, you can't go into the one down the road?
Can't ask for a double patty.
Can't you?
I've got no. I mean, I suppose I could if I asked very nicely.
Here's a cool fact. a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
One of the things we normally do is we normally try and eat some of the things on Desert Island Crisps. Now, the schmaltz herring, I didn't have enough warning to, otherwise I could have got it in.
Anti-seamite.
And
we could have,
you know, and then the chopped meat, the fillet fish. I want to skip number four, just briefly. Yeah. I've got some squid. Can I grill you some squid? Because the cat's going mental.
Yeah. Are you going to do it sort of very simply? I can't, you're not going to put any kind of pretentious stuff on it.
Well, I could just give it to the cat.
All right. No, well, no, no. Is it soft? It's not going to taste like your underpants.
Actually, I would put a griddle on the top. Look, okay.
How are you doing it? Like, I want to know what you're doing as you're doing it.
Okay, I put a cast iron griddle on top of a heat. I put a very, very hot heat. I would just chop it into very fine rings.
Yeah.
And then I would usually put a little bit of garlic.
Perfect.
And a little bit of chili.
Yeah.
And then squeeze some lemon on.
Heaven.
Will you eat that?
I have to say, there is something. Look how you're using that knife. Shh. I always used to watch Nigella and be really cross. I was never invited to the dinner parties at the end.
So I'm just
and there always used to be Alan Yentob. Yeah, he used to make me furious. Yentob, how come Yentob got invited? Where's my invitation?
I've had dinner at Nigella's with Alan Yentob. In fact, he was sitting in the bath with Sacha Baron Cohen swapping shoes.
But watching you do this, this is Desert Island, this is bucket list stuff.
Well, I've just sliced some very, very, very... fresh squid.
Yeah.
It's not baby, because it's not the time of year. It's in the summer, squid is slightly bigger.
That's
right. It's not big, big, big. It's
great. I was kosher until I was, I suppose, a young teenager. And for people who don't know, kosher food has to be slaughtered in the kosher way, the ritual way. But also... the meat has to chew the cud and have split hooves. That's sort of why pork isn't kosher. Also, it's specifically prescribed in the Torah. But also, people don't necessarily know about seafood. So a kosher fish has to have fins and scales. That's how you know it's kosher. So seafood was absolutely out. And, you know, I remember eating seafood for the first time when I was a young teenager and just sort of thinking, what is this heaven?
It squeezes a bit of
just simple that is.
Lemon.
You've got
and
some
then...
really good lemon. Where did it, was it fresh squid, do you think?
The squid? Oh, it was caught yesterday.
Oh my god, that's ripped.
Good. Tell me what comes flooding back to you. In my ideal world, we'd have time for me to cook eight things, but we've only got one.
So, when I go on holiday, not much of a party, but food is everything, and simple food. And there's this place in Ibiza on Escavalet called Il Chiringuito. Have you been there?
Mm.
And all they do is simple stuff. You know, an ounce of pretension's worth a bucket load of horse turd, as far as I'm concerned, in food. If it's longer than a sentence, I don't want to eat it.
So this is... good stuff, though, this squid, eh?
Oh, my God.
I'm so glad to be able to... I would have... We're eating a delicious squid, which is your trafe.
It's my trafe, and like I say, it's holidays in Ibiza, Spain. Simple food, simple ingredients, just cooked perfectly. You're like perhaps a sea bass done in salt.
Mm.
Just simple.
And then you talk about that holiday number six, and we'll come back to number four.
Mm-hmm.
But number six, you also say, I gather, is to do with your best ever holiday, which is caviar with sour cream.
Right.
Now, I didn't have time, thanks to Ben, to get real caviar.
Leave Ben alone.
Because our sponsors being Fortnum and Mason, I bet they'd have got us some.
Are they really?
I've got lumpfish caviar. Would you eat that with some sour cream?
Yeah, that's all right. I mean,
And a blini, or would you think...
No, it's fine, I'll have that. I mean, it's a bit of a schnorrer thing to do. There you are.
I know it's a typical schnorrer thing, but I've got some caviar, I've got some sour cream.
Can we explain what schnorrer is? Schnorrer.
Explain what a schnorrer is. Tell me why, tell me about caviar and sour cream.
My one, the one word I always teach to my non-Jewish friends is schnorrer. It's so beautiful. It basically means being tight or mean. But it's more than being mean, it's a state of mind. It's like sort of halitosis of the human soul. It's that thing, you know, when you get like, you get a little bit, or, you know, you show up somewhere and they can't quite, you know, there's not enough to go round. Lumpfish caviar, what can I tell you? I feel terrible. How can I have come round without that? Schnorrer is showing up to your birthday and eating your food.
Well, look, in the world of COVID, basically, this is as close as I'm getting to a birthday party. So, Iris, you can't, shall I give Iris, I'll give her some caviar. Do you know this, these cats, I'll be
You're
honest
You're giving
with
your
you.
Cat caviar?
Yeah, uh-huh. I'll give the cat some caviar, okay? Do you want some sour cream with your caviar? Shall I give the cat some sour cream? Come on, cat. Look, I'll put it on here. But the point is, Esther will get angry if I feed the cat at the thing, because we're trying to train that.
Train it to do cat. What? Your cat's like
not get on the table.
Your cat's like some sort of... Your cat's Mariah Carey's spirit animal. It's fascinating how food like this can genuinely change your mood. Don't you think?
Yeah.
The food that you love absolutely, happily interferes with your cat. Like, it sort of can delight you in a way that nothing else can.
Well, this is why on
Not
Desert
booze.
Island. This is why on Desert Island, Chris, we try and actually eat the food if we can, because it is mood altering in here. So it looks nice. It's not going to taste like.
I don't care if it's not the real deal.
Real caviar. So you ate this amazing. On a, you crossed Russia by train.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was a kind of.
And once upon a time, Jews crossed Russia by train. Yeah. For very different reasons.
No, that's true. I always think that's why I retain so much fat. Is because, you know, genetically speaking, we're always being slung out of places, and not so much food. And so, you know, my body is constantly thinking it's, you know, only 2 minutes before you leave Anatevka, keep that belly flat on. Keep that belly flab on.
Well, have some put some belly flab on now. With my apologies that it's lumpfish. Sorry. I mean, it's good lumpfish, and it's nice to have a blini and a sort of, you know?
That's so good.
This one's for you as well. And there's lots more where it came from. I mean, the cats have had some.
It's so good.
Well, look, how did you leap? Let's do this while you're finishing off your caviar.
Yeah.
How did you make the leap? Well, it seems to me that you're such a performer. Now, a lot of barristers think of themselves as performers, you know, and they can go,
what was that noise?
That was someone perorating. That's my
what you're doing in front of the jury. You're in the middle of a murder trial.
I hesitate to rise, Your Honour. I put it to you. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's what I quite. You know, luckily, I'm a journalist, so I never. Is that the wrong noise? I can imagine that. So you chose to be one tiny glass of wine, and suddenly, when I was a 80 years and 10. Anyway, so you obviously have some performer in you. Come on, you did Look at You on Strictly. You know, you have that in you.
Yeah. Well, I'd done National Youth Theatre. So I had when I was 14. I was too young. But I was sort of, you know, averagely okay. I got into National Youth Theatre, which was sort of an okay experience. But I got to university and I tried out for a part thinking I'd have another go. And, you know, I read for it and I could hear myself being okay. Sort of a Holby City okay, you know. And then I heard an actor read it and I thought, yeah, that's what it was. It was like an epiphany moment, you know. Like somebody...
Because your best mates, well, your good mates with Cumberbatch.
Right, and I saw him genuinely, and I thought, well, there's just no point, really. Mm-hmm. And so I've stopped doing all of that and got involved in debating and ended up becoming a barrister and became quite serious about it and wrote a small tome a few years in about money laundering and ended up my practice... I used to do murders and that sort of thing. The last murder I did, defended in with the Old Bailey, was in 2010. After that, it was mainly kind of international law, and I got appointed to... advised the special prosecutor in the Turks and Caicos Islands, which I only knew where it was when I went to the interview because I used to keep notes on Miss World every year, and those used to be Miss Turks and Caicos. But I had no idea especially where it was. And the long and short of it is the government had been suspended for corruption and the UK had reimposed direct rule. They'd recolonised the place. And I went out there to assist. And it was sort of lovely for the first sort of week, you know, like lovely beach holiday. After the sort of fifth week of sun and sand and me putting orange carrot oil on my face, and I was put on quite a lot of weight, put my wig on when I came back, I looked like an Oompa Loompa. I was
getting Ray Winston sexy beast.
Right. Oh, you're so nice. No, not even close. And it became fairly dull. And on the weekend, I used to write scripts and that sort of thing. And I went came back and I got kind of depressed about the job. I'd sort of lost my love and passion for it. You know, you have a finite amount of emotional capital to engage in whatever you do. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be perfect all the time or delightful or funny or even good, but you have to retain a sort of thin interest in it to replenish yourself. And I just lost it, especially when it's as challenging and as difficult as that. And
as being a criminal barrister.
Yeah, yeah. Well, doing international law and being away from home and, you know, the high stakes involved and all the rest of it. Mm-hmm. And I'd lost it. And I came back here to do a case in Croydon. No criticism of Croydon. I ended up writing this thing with this production company, went to flog it to this woman at ITV. She gave it her undivided indifference. But I think she may have thought it was the worst thing she'd ever read. I'd noticed that she had written some chick lit, as they call it. And I read it. And it was, despite having, you know, immersed myself in Jackie Collins, it was a lesson for me. You know, all sorts of things. Just because you've read the brochure doesn't mean you want to go on the package holiday. Who knew that some of these things were there? So much.
The gentlemen and ladies do together.
Right. So much can go wrong, I discovered. Anyway, she ended up saying, look, are you qualified perhaps to sit in a TV courtroom? Because she did telly. You know about telly.
Yeah.
Telly is nonsense. You know, basically people who are in telly have meetings for two purposes. One, to kind of politically position themselves, to claim all the credit in the event that things go well, and to deny all the responsibility in the event that it's not a hit, right? Yes. And nothing ever happens. It takes ages. I just have meetings. So I just ignored it. Didn't think it was, like, real. Because we hadn't even done a taster tape or anything of that kind. I'd never been on telly before. And she turned out to be this maverick producer. I, in fact, took a brief in Jersey. I was advising their government there on this big and important public inquiry they were having into systematic child abuse. And then it turned out this was happening. And I flied to Salford, where the court is, and there was my name. And I had absolutely, I didn't believe it was happening. I hadn't prepared myself at all. That's how unplanned the whole thing
and
was.
And Judge Judy existed in America.
Sure, so I'd known that one. Of course. But also I learned a huge amount. You know, by that time, I was doing high-value, multi-billion dollar cases and stuff. And of course I'd kept my hand in another work. But, you know, my life had, you know, moved on from arm's length of the lived experiences of people outside of my London bubble. And I can't tell you, well, I can tell you, the gift. I really mean it, the gift of insight that I've had by doing Judge Render. And people sometimes maybe sneer at it, but those people
who sneers? Lawyers?
No, lawyers have been great about it, actually. As have my colleagues. And boy, would I... And boy, did I keep saying boy? What's wrong with me? And I'm in a really serious set of chambers. And I think that's because they are busy and the best at what they do. And people who are like that never sneer at other people. Actually, a case number two, they're not supposed to speak in my ear, the producer. Mm-hmm. But I'll never forget it. It was years ago now. And the case in front of me, between two litigants, hello, whatever, I start the case and I say, oh, this case is about £97. That's not a lot of money. And my senior producer, who, you know, is just the most extraordinary person, she's sort of, she's from the Black Country. There's nothing better I can say about anybody than that. You know, she's just absolutely brilliant. If she had a Native American name, it would be Punches with a Fist. And she started speaking my head. Do you want to rephrase that? You sound like a right posh head. And I thought it was great. And she was right. And year after year, case after case, you learn more than I could ever have hoped to learn. You know, I've tried, for example, to fill in a universal credit form. And I'm no academic slouch. I found it impossible.
Really?
And you realise, but for adding several noughts onto the cases, in many instances, we all share in the same thing. Only the difference between a lot of the people in my court and perhaps you is lots of them don't have access to justice. Mm. What I mean by that is a network of friends, when they've got some sort of legal problem, they can ask for help or get it resolved, etc. And to that extent, you know, it's been, again, and I use the word on purpose, a privilege. And consequently, I was able, I think, in fact, I did predict everything that came politically. I knew full well that the lives of people in London, in my small, limited community, was wholly different from what was happening outside.
You mean Brexit was a thing you could see coming?
For sure. For absolute sure. Absolutely. I was warning everybody that would listen.
Tell me about beer bottles.
Ah, this is amazing. Beer bottles are cola bottles, but they're the posh version. They're really hard to get. They do them now in those kind of posh shops around Leicester Square. They're hard to get hold of. And so it reminds me of school, primary school, after they used to sell them in those great big tubs.
You know, like beer bottles.
Yeah, you could get beer bottles then. Obviously, they didn't have beer in them. They weren't sort of, you know, feeding alcohol to kids even back then in the 80s. But I used to leave Osage School in Southgate and I'd get a great big thing. My grandma would sort of live around the corner and would feed us and we'd get like a great big bag of beer bottles. And it reminds me of doing gymnastics with Mr. Crawshaw. I was really good at it. I can still do it, actually. And
what can you do? You proper...
Front flips, cartwheel. In fact, I was doing it in the garden with my nephews the other week. And I forgot that I was well into my 40s. And the next day I picked up a weight. And, you know, when your back go, have you had your back go yet? Yeah. My back, I'm like, what is this? You know, you forget that I, you know, I'm falling to bits. But it reminds me of that, the delight in doing gymnastics. And even now, they are my sweet of choice. So I have them insofar as I can, certainly cola bottles or beer bottles if I can get hold of them, but usually cola bottles, in the my chambers, which is a bit like a green room. And it also now reminds me of being and doing Judge Rinder, which I passionately love. I'm kind of in love with the show. Mm-hmm. I'm in love with the programme. You know, despite, as I say, what some people perhaps think about it, when they get into it, the reason it survived is because we don't just treat it seriously. The people that work on it really care about it. And it really does matter to me. It matters... You know, despite, like I say, from time to time, some of the cases are funny, to be sure. But it matters that people learn about the law and the people who come to the courtroom leave feeling that they've been heard and have had the opportunity to speak and hear one another. And very often that makes all the difference.
Okay, anchovies, number 7. Now listen, I've got some anchovies, I've got some boccarones.
I love
I've got some tomato, but I haven't really got any very good bread.
Should That's we have right. No, we can have a non-carb version.
We have a non-carb because you're on a diet anyway.
Yeah.
So we just have.
Well, I'm trying to be on a diet. I can't.
I've got a feeling the cat will go crazy.
I'm too depressed.
This will be perfect for your diet.
Is that okay? I'm really trying. I think the problem is that it's the alcohol. Like when you have a drink, then it's like the gateway drug to food.
Yeah. These are good ones as well.
Did you get them from a fishmonger?
Yeah, these are some proper boccarones.
So it would be, this is my holiday, again, with the squid. Mm-hmm. This reminds me of summer holidays, usually in Spain, but it could be anywhere else, when they serve, with beer. Do you not agree? It's the type of food, the sort of sense memory, that you can kind of bite into it. And, you know, the day isn't, but it takes me ages to relax in a holiday. Usually I'm kind of on the way to the airport, back. By the time I sort of relaxed enough. And that's especially problematic as we're invaded by these little tubs of cruelty.
He says, picking up his iPhone.
Right.
You're listening in black and white.
You know, the kind of perpetual invasion. But I can bite into an anchovy and have a glass of beer. And it's like breathing out. It's like lovely somehow. It's just, it's relaxation.
And
like
probably something that's not happening this year for you?
No. I might go to Italy if they keep it open. We'll see.
So number 8, I see the word cholent. And a favourite thing of mine, oxtail soup cholent.
Yeah.
Now,
well, she calls it
this.
Cholent or she calls it oxtail soup. So I was going to go naturally for chicken soup. The problem is that you'd inevitably ask me who makes the best and the kind of ensuing violence in my family that would cause. I mean, that broigus, as in the feud, that would trigger.
I love a broigus. Come on, who cooks the best chicken soup?
No, absolutely no comment. I'm perfectly, desirous of being in all of these people's wills. There's absolutely no way I'm saying who makes the best chicken soup. I know who it is and she knows who it is. But I'm not blabbing. No way whatsoever. My wonderful human, I call her my wonderful human. So I grew up with my stepsisters and my dad had a son and a daughter as well. But I was close to my stepsister and especially one of them was the same age as me. But sadly, she died in 2001. I loved her very much. And her mum and I have become very, very, very close. I love her very dearly. And she's the most extraordinary cook. Her kitchen is a magical space. In fact, not only is she a cook, but she used to be a very senior HR person. And I have friends from a variety of walks of life that will go and sit in her kitchen thinking about changing career, whatever, and she will make food. And within 18 months, your life will be changed in some way. That's the rule of thumb. It's happened to everybody that sat in her kitchen. And the food somehow tastes different. You know, stuff that I would never eat elsewhere tastes different in her kitchen. Quark, rhubarb, you know, stuff that would make you, you know, hurl. What's that? You know, it'll give a, you know, it triggers your gag reflex.
Quark.
Yeah, what is that? Sort of like a yogurt stuff.
Oh,
cool. Tastes horrible.
No.
Well, I don't know what it's called. I don't know. But anyway, stuff that would taste horrible, that would give you a gag reflex for all of the wrong reasons, in her kitchen just somehow tastes amazing. And one of the things she made when I was unwell was oxtail soup. Now, it's sort of chulenty, but it's not quite a chulent. It's got butter beans in it. All
so to explain
stuff.
To our listeners, chulent is a Jewish, Eastern Middle European stew dish. Beans,
right.
usually a bone, a marrow bone.
Right.
Beans, sometimes barley, sometimes paprika, if
right.
you're further west.
A variety of things. And the reason you made it is because you'd keep it on a low heat over the Shabbat period, because you couldn't turn on the...
Indeed, in the shtetl, Claudia Roden would have us believe in her book of Jewish food that,
yeah.
that you would make it on the Friday morning.
That's right.
And then take it to the shtetl and take it, because people didn't have, had to unkindle their fires.
Right.
Take it to the baker.
That's
who
right.
had turned off the ovens for the bread, but leave it overnight so that when you came back, so very cooling, you know.
Yeah.
So when you came back from shul in the morning, the family right. would go and pick up
absolutely
the shulent from...
My grandfather used to do that, the baker's family. He used to make the most amazing cakes and food. Just food was so...
And they did the challenge as well.
I think so, yeah. But
your
when,
friend's oxtail
when I was unwell, she used to come and leave deliveries sort of outside of the house. And she made this for me. And my taste had just come back.
From the
COVID. And it was just... I can't even describe what it was like.
Is
I was
it
like,
a soup?
It's a sort of soupy, it's a soupy version of chulent. But it's just like, it's meaty and tasty and rich and textured and just layered. It's got all of the things like, you know, obviously various herbs and spices. It's full of the secrets of what it means to be a good mother. That's the best way I can describe it. You know, you can live a whole life. And even if you're taught the recipe, never, ever be able to recreate it. It's restorative. You know, it's somehow the way that food can exist as poetry or joy. That's what it felt like. Anyway, you've got some over there.
Yeah, I saw you brought... you brought a frozen...
It takes what you need to defrost it properly, I think. I think you might need to add water as well, because it might be a bit clobby. But that's got a oxtail. Oxtails are always funny as well, because when you clean the bones,
yeah.
they look like little cows. It's really...
They do. They yeah. do. No, a bone in there is very important.
Quite.
That sounds absolutely delicious. Well, suppose I would have to ask you, in the tradition of the desert island, if you could only have one of these... Mm. Eight dishes to live on your desert island, what would you keep?
Well, it would be the schmaltz herring, but I'd get really thirsty, so there'd be a water supply.
I assume there is a water supply. So you have the schmaltz herring and all the memories.
Can I have the scotch with it?
As your first thing was schmaltz herring with onions and a glass of scotch. That's what you can have.
Well, just the glass. I want to get absolute...
A bottomless glass.
Oh, fine,
it's a bottomless glass of scotch and some schmaltz herring. So when they do find you, you'll be very, very drunk and quite smelly.
Smelly and fat. Well, where's the change?
Rob Rinder, thank you very much for sharing your Desert Island crisps.
It's been a joy. Thank you, love.
You've been listening to Desert Island Crisps, a special treat edition of the podcast culled from my Times Radio show. It's a Wireless Studios production for Times Radio, produced by my pet millennial, well, they do understand the tech, Ben Mitchell. If you like this edition, please let us know, and in the future we might be able to bring you more from my desert island, where the build-up of hungry celebrities is beginning to make social distancing very difficult indeed. But for now, for more Desert Island Crisps, tune into my live radio show on Times Radio on Fridays from 1 till 4 on your DAB radio, online, or using the shiny new Times Radio app, where you can also hear a whole host of Times podcasts, such as Red Box with the fabulous Matt Chorley, your political hit of the day, or Split Opinion with former Home Secretary Amber Rudd and her journalist daughter Flora Gill, where they argue about a different topic each week, with special guests including former London mayoral candidate Rory Stewart and the comedian Catherine Ryan. You can also binge on the back catalogue of this award-nominated podcast, Giles Corran Has No Idea, which is available on the Times Radio app or wherever else you get your podcasts, including Acast, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and more.
Hold up.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.